WDBM East Lansing.
Welcome to the Sci-Files, an Impact 89 FM series that explores student research here at Michigan State University. We're your co-hosts, Madi Dowling
and Dimitri Joseph.
Hi, today the Sci-Files at the Graduate Academic Conference. To start up, we have Sam Norcia and Shar Dengler, who are from the College of Nursing, and they're going to tell us a little bit about their research. Hi guys, thank you for joining us, and could you explain a little bit about what your research is?
Thank you for having us. So our research deals with patient portal adoption and how it affects patient satisfaction, and our quality improvement project occurred at a clinic here on campus, a nurse practitioner-led family practice clinic, and it was done to improve patient satisfaction. We discussed clinic needs or concerns with the community liaison, and it was decided then that they would like to work on patient satisfaction. At that point, my project partner Sam and I went ahead and did a literature review, and we're like, what can help with increasing or improving patient satisfaction? And it was discovered that patient portal adoption is a great tool to improve patient satisfaction. How do we get patients to adopt a portal? How do we bump that? Further review of the literature revealed that education is a key tool to having people adopt the portal. And I'll have Sam take over from here.
Okay, so in the literature review, we found that education for providers and staff improves portal adoption rate. So what we did was we had two in-services with the staff and providers at the clinic, and we introduced our project, we introduced ourselves, we educated them on the benefits of patient portals, asked for feedback on what they felt about patient portals, how they were already trying to discuss the portal with their patient and their current processes at the clinic. And then from there, we met with a graphic artist at MSU and created patient portal brochures. And the brochures included patient education on the benefits of the portal, how to sign up for a portal, proxy access, meaning for older adults that aren't tech savvy, pick someone they trust to access their portal for them, and then also for under the age of 13, for those patients who can see their portal and all those types of things. So the brochures were passed out upon patient check-in. When they checked into the front desk, if you weren't signed up for a portal, you would get a brochure. And then also we created poster versions of the brochures that were placed on the back of all exam room doors, so patients were exposed to it during the appointment to see the poster and how to sign up for the portal and all that. For measuring all of our data, over the 3-month time, we receive portal adoption rate percentages throughout the months. Also patient satisfaction scores that were given to us in percentage form. So prior to our intervention, this was September of 2023, portal adoption rate was below 70%. And then at the end of our intervention, January of 2024, it increased to 76%. So there was a 6% jump in portal adoption rate. And then patient satisfaction scores started around 50% in September. And this was well below the national benchmark, which the clinic wanted to reach. And they jumped up to over 80% at the end of our intervention. So we saw that as portal adoption rate went up, patient satisfaction scores went up. And a lot of the research that we did said it was because patients had a better relationship with their provider because they were able to message them, they empowered their health, they chose healthier lifestyles, they were more aware of all their lab results and things like that. So although patient portal adoption rate and patient satisfaction scores went up, there's no scientific evidence to say they are correlated because we didn't have the raw data, but it's definitely an area for future study.
There was some burden associated with portal use and some frustration that, you know, they're working through the portal and there was concern about reimbursement for their time spent working with patients. So during our literature review, we did find evidence for reimbursement. So now insurance companies are recognizing that providers do need to be reimbursed. And so if they are making medical decisions while working with the patient through the portal, they are probably going to be eligible for reimbursement. So that's very important findings. And then also our intervention is reproducible and sustainable because our brochures, our educational tools have been adopted by the MSU clinics. So that was pretty exciting. The bottom line, patient satisfaction bumped up 30%.
Did you provide any updates to the portal, or was the portal already established and the main focus was to increase the usage of patient portals?
The patient portal was already established. So our goal was to just increase awareness of what it does, what it provides, and to improve the amount of people signed up for the portal.
And just to give our listeners foundational understanding, what is a patient portal?
Patient portal is a platform where patients can access this platform via computer, via tablet, via smartphone, and it's website connected to the electronic health record that's linked to the clinic where they obtain their care. In most patient portals, you can communicate with your provider, you can make appointments or request appointments, you can ask for refills, you can pay your bills. There's a variety of options based on what clinic asks for options for their portal.
From what I'm hearing, it's a way to communicate to the medical team. It makes sense that making someone aware that they have this tool will increase their satisfaction. So I'm glad that you two have done this research and highlighted that.
I can imagine that it alleviates also the frustration of having to call an office and wait for the call back and wait to get your lab results and things like that.
To be completely transparent, there are some limitations or issues relating to patient portal use. Of course, it can be frightening if you find something in your portal for results that you're not understanding or that needs to be further discussed with your provider before the provider can review it and get back to you. So there are some disclosures or warnings that some of the things that you may read might be upsetting to you. Please contact the office if you have any questions or concerns, and it just freely allows the patient to have that insight. But on the other side of things, some patients look at it and think that the provider already knows what the results are. Like, say they get the results at 9 a.m., the results are in the computer at 3 p.m. They're like, why hasn't the doctor called me yet? Mm-hmm. You know, so we try to talk with patients too about realistic expectations about hearing back and also what is appropriate to communicate through the portal. So say if a patient is having chest pain, they wouldn't, hey doctor, I'm having, or provider, I'm having chest pain. No, you would go to the emergency room. And also, we did share in our brochure, our educational tool, that the response would typically take 3 to 5 days. The bigger picture for our portal adoption, not only does it affect patient satisfaction, but it also has the possibility to affect decreasing emergency room visits, decreasing hospital admissions, and actually increasing overall healthcare dollars spent. So it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Very cool and very important research that you guys are undertaking. So thank you so much for sharing this with us, and we hope to hear more in the future.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have Bismarck Amanyangpong with us to discuss his research. Hi, Bismarck. Could you tell us a little bit about what your research entails?
So my lab is a molecular biology lab. We also do a bit of organic chemistry and synthetic biology. And so what we basically do is that we identify microorganisms. We engineer or evolve those organisms to consume a particular carbon source, and then that organism produces whatever compound wanted to produce. And so, for instance, if you want the organism to produce lactic acid, which is a monomer for making biodegradable materials, then we can engineer the microbes to produce that.
I love this topic, so I can see why you love your science so much.
It's interesting. Yeah. I mean, think about how you can manipulate an organism to achieve like a benefit.
You are encompassing synthetic biology to its core, where you're manipulating an organism to do something productive to what you see fit. So that brings to the question, what are the major compounds or molecules that you're most interested in producing?
For my research, I'm looking at producing lactic acid, which is, as I said, used to making biodegradable materials, and shikimic acid. And so this is the precursor that is used to making Tamiflu.
Mm. What is Tamiflu?
Tamiflu is, it's used in treating flu, right?
To treat influenza. Yeah,
influenza, exactly. And so back in the days, the way that this precursor was made was to harvest it from the plants. And so you take a plant, extract some ethanol or I don't know what particular solvent, extract that compound from the plant. But that would mean that we have to cut down all those plants, right? Mm. In order to get them. And so back in the days, my PI developed a way to feed E. coli which is a microbe in our gut, engineer that E. coli, feed it with glucose, and then that engineered microbe will produce shikimic acid, which can then be converted into the active ingredient in terms of
Cool.
Yeah.
In order to do the science that you practice, you have to understand a lot of different fields. For instance, the microbes and the ability to manipulate the systems or engineer the DNA and the RNA and the molecules that are producing your goal of interest. Could you give us some insight about some of the biology that you're changing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I go from where I begin, right? The reason why my project is at least more interesting to me is that we are not looking at starting with glucose. Now, currently, most chemicals are made from, you know, petroleum sources or some kind of corn, stoba, you know, using like fermentation processes. If you look at the petroleum route, it requires lots of amount of energy, energy intensive, it's expensive and all that. Now, these processes also produce carbon dioxide and methane pollution, right? These guys are accumulating, increased global warming, changes the pattern of climate. And so our research focuses on capturing this CO2 and methane, converting those into bacterial food, and then feeding that to the engineered microbe. And so I guess the main challenge of that was, how do I force the microorganism to consume the unknown food, right? And you can think of it this way. It's like you have someone who is a meat lover, and then you're like, okay, no more meat for you. Let's just give you veggies, right? And so if there's no food to eat, the organism will starve for some time, a couple of hours, I don't know, maybe a day or two, but it wouldn't die. It would consume those veggies. And so what happened was that when I get the CO2 or methane-derived bacterial food or chemical, we call it ADCA, the microbes first were not consuming it. And so I had to expose these microbes over and over again for a period of 8 days until they start consuming it as they were consuming their favorite food, glucose. And so that alone causes the bacteria to engineer themselves. We call that evolution.
Cool.
Yeah.
Interesting. So it almost seems like you're engineering them at two different levels, two different ends, where it's like the intake and the outtake.
Exactly. Yep.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
How did you guys come up with that as being the mechanism that you wanted to go after?
Right. And so once we had a starting point, like a feedstock, mostly people use glucose, right? And there's been research to use other compounds too, like lignin from other parts of plants. But like those comes with their own challenges. So first we identified the main problem, CO2 and methane. We want to be able to improve, or if it's inexistent at all, like make sure that these microorganisms can consume this starting material. And so that was the main challenge. So that was just a test and error to see if they'll consume it. Yeah. If they didn't consume it, then we can find a different route around that. I guess one route that we found around that was to convert the CO2 and methane to the bacterial food alcohol. We call that acetylene dicarboxylic acid, right? ADCA. It's a 4-carbon. The two ends are carboxylate groups. And then in the middle, the two carbons in the middle have triple bonds. And so that resembles a compound that we find in E. coli. And so we thought that, okay, if this compound resembles something that is already in their system, then most likely they should be able to consume it. So that is how we ended up converting CO2 and methane to ADCA and then feeding that ADCA to the microorganism. Now, when it comes to the ending part, that was more about showing what we can do. And so we chose the two compounds, lactic acid, 3 carbons, simple, it has a chiral center. Then we chose shikimic acid, which is pharmaceutical. And so we are showing that we can make a commodity chemical for making polymers and a pharmaceutical, which is more like an expensive molecule.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you, Bismarck, for giving us that very complete explanation of from the beginning, the middle, and the end about how you're using this microbe and feeding it something that it typically doesn't prefer. But through the chemical structure information, you had a hypothesis that believed that this was an appropriate chemical that can be used downstream production. Thank you. Thank you for doing the beautiful science that you do.
Thanks.